Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. You know, we're diving into the world of LLMs again.
Always exciting stuff.
Yeah, things are moving so fast, it can be hard to even keep up with all the new developments. But, you know, that's kind of what we're here for, to help break it all down.
Absolutely. Try to make sense of it all.
Exactly. And today we've got a particularly fascinating collection of research papers to dig into. What's really striking this time around is the focus isn't just on building bigger and bigger models.
Right. Not just scaling up for the sake of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's about being smarter. More strategic.
More efficient.
Right? Like, how can we make these models not just powerful, but also incredibly efficient, both in how they're trained and how they actually operate?
And I think one of the most compelling findings that keeps emerging is that sometimes less is more.
Oh, tell me about it. There's this study we're going to unpack today that found just a small but really carefully chosen data set. We're talking maybe 1,000 examples can actually outperform a data set that's 10 times larger.
It's remarkable, isn't it? When you think about it, it really challenges the notion that simply throwing more data at a problem is always the best solution.
Yeah, it definitely seems like we're moving into a phase where quality trumps quantity when it comes to training data.
Absolutely. And this has implications not just for performance, but for efficiency as well. Training these massive models requires a lot of computational power. So being able to achieve better results with smaller data sets is a huge win.
Okay, so let's jump into our first deep dive. We're going to start with a study that focuses on a key process called instruction tuning. This is essentially the process of fine-tuning these large language models so they can actually follow instructions.
So instead of just generating text somewhat aimlessly, we want them to perform specific tasks in response to our commands.
Right. And this study put a bunch of different methods to the test to figure out which ones were the best at selecting the optimal training data for this instruction tuning process.
Makes sense. If we want these models to be good at following instructions, we need to carefully choose the data we use to teach them how to do that.
They tested a bunch of different approaches. Some methods analyze those internal adjustments the model makes, those gradients, during training to see how the data influences those adjustments.
So kind of like figuring out which data points have the most significant impact on the model's learning process.
Exactly. Other methods create these kind of conceptual maps. Think of it as a high-dimensional space where similar concepts are clustered together, and they look at how data points are positioned within this map.
So they're looking at semantic relationships between different data points, trying to find the ones that are most relevant to the task at hand.
Yep. And they even looked at methods that basically predict how well the model already understands certain pieces of data.
I imagine the intuition there is that if the model already has a good grasp of a particular concept or example, maybe it doesn't need to be explicitly trained on it as much.
Makes sense. So you would naturally think that the most complex, computationally intensive techniques would be the winners, right?
It seems logical. You'd assume more sophisticated methods would lead to better results.
But here's the kicker. The study found that a surprisingly straightforward method actually came out on top. It's called representation-based data similarity, or RDS plus for short.
RDS plus, ooh, interesting. I'm curious to hear more about that.
Yeah, it's all based on the idea of looking at the data through the lens of how a pre-trained language model itself understands it. So they take a pre-trained model and look at its internal activations, those hidden states when it processes different pieces of data. And they use these activations to create these numerical representations of the data, kind of like mapping them onto this conceptual map we talked about earlier.
So they're using the pre-trained model's own understanding of the data to guide the selection process? That's pretty clever.
It is, and RDS Plus had a few really significant advantages. One that stood out was, unlike many other methods, its performance actually got better as the pool of data they were selecting from grew larger.
That's counterintuitive, isn't it? You'd think a more basic method might struggle to keep up when faced with huge amounts of data.
Right. You'd think it would get overwhelmed. But no, it actually seemed to thrive in that environment.
It suggests RDS Plus is really good at uncovering patterns and relationships in the data that are maybe less obvious at smaller scales.
Yeah, I think that's a key insight here. And it wasn't just about handling large volumes of data. RDS Plus also really excelled at picking out the most useful data for training a model to handle multiple different tasks simultaneously. So think of a model that needs to be able to summarize text, answer questions, translate languages, all that stuff.
That's where things get really interesting in terms of practical applications. We want these models to be versatile, right?
Exactly. And whether they were choosing from a pool of like 10,000 examples or a massive 2.5 million, RDS Plus consistently outperformed the other methods.
That's a compelling argument for its versatility.
Okay, ready for another mind-blowing tidbit. The researchers found that RDS Plus even did better than a model called 2U2. And 2U2, get this, was trained on data that was specifically handpicked by humans.
Wow, so they're basically saying this automated method, RDS plus A, is better at choosing training data than we are.
It's pretty remarkable, right? The researchers point out that a lot of the earlier work in this field mainly looked at much smaller data sets and usually just focused on one specific task. There were some studies this year, one by Year and Rush, another by Didi and Ippolito, but they were mostly working with smaller data sets, around 10,000 samples, and data pools that weren't that large, maybe 200,000 at most.
So this new study, by scaling things up significantly, really changes our perspective on which data selection methods are the most effective for these large language models that are becoming increasingly common.
Yeah, the scale really matters here. Okay, so let's get a little more technical. How does RDS Plus actually do its magic?
I'm all ears.
Well, it's a specific variation of representation-based data similarity. So remember those hidden states, the internal activations of the language model.
Yes, I remember. It's like looking inside the model's brain, seeing how it represents different concepts.
Precisely. RDS Plus specifically focuses on the hidden states from the very last layer of the pre-training model. And then it does this weighted averaging of the hidden states across the entire input sequence.
So not all positions in the sequence are treated equally. It seems like they're giving more importance to certain parts, maybe the beginning or the end.
Exactly. They found that this position-weighted averaging was the key to making RDS Plus really effective.
It makes sense that certain parts of the input might be more informative than others. It's like when you're reading a news article, you often get the gist from the headline in the first few paragraphs.
Totally. They tested out a bunch of different data selection methods in the study, 9 in total.
So they covered all the bases, right? From those gradient-based methods to the ones based on embeddings like RDS plus A, and even the methods that use the model's predictions to guide the selection.
Exactly. A really comprehensive comparison. And there's this table in the paper, table 1, that shows how well each method did on a single task using that huge TOR-U2 data set.
And I'm guessing RDS plus is at the top of the leaderboard.
Yep, you guessed it. They were selecting 10,000 data points for different tasks, and RDS Plus consistently outperformed all the other methods, including some much more computationally intensive ones. They even found that RDS Plus could work well for selecting data that's relevant for safety considerations.
Ah, that's crucial. As these models become more powerful and integrated into our lives, ensuring they're trained on data that aligns with ethical and safety considerations is paramount.
Absolutely. And, by being smarter about how we choose training data, we could potentially cut down on the computational resources all those SOPs needed to train these powerful models. That's a win for the environment and for cost savings.
It's a great example of how optimizing one aspect of the training process can have cascading benefits across the board.
Okay, ready for another mind-bending topic. Let's talk about making these models more efficient, not just in how we train them, but in how they actually operate.
So, squeezing out more performance with fewer resources.
Precisely. And model quantization is a key technique here. It's about reducing the precision of the numbers that represent the model's weights and activations.
Kind of like using fewer digits to represent a number. You might lose a little bit of accuracy, but you gain a lot in terms of storage and computational efficiency.
Yeah, it's a trade-off, but often a worthwhile one. This paper introduces a method called RSQ, and one of the really cool things about it is how it tackles this problem of weight outliers.
Weight outliers, what are those?
So in these really huge language models, some of the weights, those numerical values that determine how the model processes information, can be way bigger than others. And these outliers are kind of a pain when you're trying to quantize the model.
Because reducing the precision might have a bigger impact on those extreme values, potentially throwing off the calculations.
Exactly. So what RSQ does is it applies this special mathematical transformation, an orthogonal transformation.
Orthogonal transformation? That sounds complicated.
It's actually a rotation. They rotate the model's weight matrices to kind of redistribute those extreme values, making them less of a problem during quantization.
Clever. But doesn't changing the weights mess with how the model works?
That's where this cool property of transformer architectures comes in computational invariance, especially when they use RMS norm root mean square layer normalization.
RMS norm, I vaguely remember hearing about that. It's a way of normalizing the activations within the model, right?
Exactly. And a lot of the current large language models actually use a different normalization method called layer norm.
Right, layer norm, that sounds familiar.
But you can actually convert layer norm to RMS norm mathematically. And with RMS norm, you can do these rotations without messing up the model's output. It's like rearranging the furniture without changing the actual layout of the room.
I'm starting to see how this all fits together.
Yeah. So they use this randomized Hadamard matrix, which is a computationally efficient way to do this rotation. And what's really interesting is that they found they could actually get better results with RSQ, even when using less data for calibration than some of the standard quantization methods like GPTQ and QuadRide.
calibration data. Remind me what that is again?
It's basically data that's used to figure out the best way to map those original high-precision weights to the new, lower-precision, quantized values.
Ah, got it. So using less calibration data means the whole process is more efficient.
Absolutely. So RSQ boils down to three main steps: rotate, scale, and quantize.
Rotate, scale, quantize. Easy to remember.
Yeah, it's a nice, clean framework. They also describe this technique called dataset expansion, where they use modified versions of the input sequences along with the original ones to identify which parts of the input are most important for the model's performance.
So it's like giving the model a slightly different perspective on the data to help it figure out what's truly essential.
They have this helpful figure in the paper, figure one, that visually explains the whole RSQ process.
I'll have to check that out. It always helps to have a visual aid.
Totally. And then they have this other table, table two, that shows how RSQ stacks up against other quantization methods across a range of different tasks. We're talking language understanding, reasoning, even math problem solving. And RSQ often comes out on top, even when they quantize the models all the way down to 3 bits.
3 bits. That's an insane level of compression. To still maintain decent performance at that level is pretty amazing.
Yeah. But they didn't stop there. They also tested RSQ on tasks that are specifically designed to see how well models handle really long sequences of text, like those found in long articles or books, you know, like the Lost in the Middle benchmark and the Elival suite, which includes COFL and quality tests.
Right. Being able to process long sequences of text is becoming increasingly crucial for many applications, so it's important to see how these quantization techniques affect performance in those scenarios.
Definitely. And what they found was kind of surprising. Just using longer sequences in the calibration data wasn't enough to guarantee good performance on these long context tasks.
It implies that there are still things we don't fully understand about how quantization interacts with the model's ability to handle very long sequences of information.
Absolutely. More research is needed there. But here's another interesting observation. Sometimes the quantized models actually did better than the original full precision 16-bit model on long ICL bench. It's a benchmark for evaluating in-context learning with long input sequences.
So quantization isn't always a compromise. Sometimes it can actually lead to improvements.
It seems that way. It might be that quantization introduces a bit of regularization, preventing the model from overfitting to the training data.
That's fascinating. It challenges our assumptions about how quantization works and its potential benefits.
Yeah, it's not just about making models smaller and faster. It might actually be making them smarter in some cases.
All right, I'm ready for the next challenge. What's next on our list?
Okay, so we've tackled data selection and quantization. Now let's dive into the complexities of handling really long sequences of text. You know, sometimes these models seem to forget what they read a few paragraphs back.
Yeah, that can be frustrating. It's like they have a limited short-term memory.
Exactly. Our third paper introduces an architecture called the Forgetting Transformer, or FOX for short.
FOX, like the animal. I'm intrigued already.
It's a clever name. And the key innovation here is the forgetting attention mechanism. It's inspired by recurrent neural networks, or RNNs, which often use a forget gate to manage information flow over time.
RNNs are those models that are specifically designed for processing sequences of data, right?
Yep, they have this built-in memory. Now, transformers don't have that explicit recurrent structure, but this paper shows how you can incorporate a similar forgetting mechanism into the attention process.
So they're essentially teaching transformers to selectively forget certain parts of the input as they process new information.
Precisely. They do this by dynamically adjusting the weights of the raw attention scores based on the actual input data.
So it's not just forgetting blindly, it's a data-driven process.
Right. They have this mathematical formula for the forget gate. It involves a sigmoid function and a few learned parameters. And this gate directly influences how the final attention scores are calculated.
It's like the model is learning to pay attention to the most relevant parts of the input while strategically downplaying the less important information.
And this forgetting attention is designed with hardware efficiency in mind. It's compatible with flash attention, which is this super-optimized algorithm for computing attention. That means it can avoid creating those massive attention matrices that take up a ton of memory.
That's crucial for scalability, especially when dealing with long sequences. The memory requirements for attention can quickly become a bottleneck.
The researchers also point out a connection to Alibi, which is another technique for handling long contexts. They suggest that forgetting attention can be seen as a more flexible, data-dependent version of Alibi.
Alibi uses fixed biases to encourage the model to focus on recent tokens. So forgetting attention is kind of like a learned, adaptive version of that.
Yep. And the Fox architecture incorporates some other interesting design choices. They have this pro-block design that integrates some elements from those recurrent neural networks we talked about, like having learnable weights for updating the key and value components in attention, and using RMS norm for normalization.
They're borrowing some ideas from RNNs to enhance the transformer's ability to process sequential data.
It seems so. Figure one in the paper shows what this Fox Pro architecture looks like. In their empirical study, they really focused on evaluating how well Fox could handle long contexts. They trained their models on a massive data set called LongCrawl 64 and compared Fox against standard transformers, as well as those other long context models like Mamba-2, HGRN-2, and DeltaNet. And they even used a large rope angle for the transformer to optimize it for long sequences.
Roped, or rotary position embeddings. That's a way to encode positional information into the model, right?
Exactly. So they were really giving the transformer every advantage.
Leveling the playing field as much as possible.
Yeah. Figure two in the paper shows the results on per token loss and perplexity across different context lengths. And Fox does quite well, even when they tested it on sequences longer than what it was trained on.
That's length extrapolation, a good test of the model's ability to generalize beyond what it's seen before.
And they did those needle-in-the-haystack tests, too, where you try to see if the model can find a specific piece of information buried in a long document. Figure 4 shows Fox holding its own against Mamba-2 and DeltaNet.
I'm impressed. It sounds like Fox is a strong contender in the world of long context language models.
Yeah, it's definitely a promising approach, and it outperforms some of the models that use sliding window attention or other techniques that only look at a limited window of the past.
So that ability to selectively forget less important information seems to be really paying off for Fox in terms of long context performance.
Okay, ready for our fourth deep dive?
Bring it on!
This one's all about making language models even more efficient during text generation. And it involves compressing that key value cache we talked about earlier.
The KV cache, that's where the model stores the key and value vectors from previous tokens, right?
Exactly. It's essential for attention, but it can get really big, especially with long sequences.
A real memory hack.
This paper introduces a technique called queue filters, and it's a way to filter out the less important key value pairs, making the cache smaller and more manageable.
Clever. But how do they determine which pairs are less important?
That's the really cool part. They do it without needing any additional training of the model. And they don't even need to access the attention weights directly, which means it plays nicely with those efficient attention algorithms like flash attention.
So it's a training-free method that works with existing optimized attention mechanisms. That's pretty impressive.
It is. And when they tested it out, queue filters proved to be really competitive with other cache compression methods, even those that directly use attention information. In fact, for text generation, it actually outperformed other efficient methods like streaming LLM.
That's a strong argument for its effectiveness. And it highlights the power of exploring these training-free techniques.
Ready for a remarkable stat. On that needle-in-the-haystack task, they achieved 99% accuracy, even with a 32-fold compression of the KV cache using queue filters.
Wow, so they're achieving significant compression without sacrificing accuracy. That's a win-win.
Yeah, it's a huge win. And they saw a significant reduction in the drop in generation quality, that's perplexity when using queue filters compared to streaming LLM.
So it's not just about making things faster, it's also about maintaining the quality of the generated text.
Absolutely. Figure one in the paper shows this really interesting comparison of accuracy versus time to first token.
Time to first token. That's essentially how long it takes for the model to start generating text, right? A key metric for user experience.
Exactly. Queue filters strikes a good balance between accuracy and speed. Now, for the technical bit.
Lay it on me.
They've observed that the distribution of those query and key vectors within these models isn't uniform. They tend to cluster in certain directions. And they found that the principal eigenvector of the query vectors, that's kind of the direction of greatest variance, can be used to estimate the importance of each key value pair.
So they're leveraging the inherent structure of these vector representations to determine which pairs are most critical.
Exactly. Queue filters uses these lightweight projections based on this eigenvector, which they calculate just once per model using a small calibration set to figure out which key value pairs can be safely discarded.
And because this eigenvector is calculated once and doesn't depend on the specific input, it's a really efficient process.
Right. And this approach works much better than another method called K-norm, which just looks at the magnitude of the key vectors. You can see this in figure 4 in the paper.
I'm always a fan of simple yet effective solutions.
They also highlight the efficiency and scalability of queue filters. It doesn't need to compute those full attention maps, so it's quite fast. Figure 9 shows how consistent those queue filters are across different datasets and even different language models.
So it's not just a fluke. It seems to be a fundamental property of these models that queue filters is exploiting.
Yep. And they have these great examples in Table 1 where you can see how queue filters correctly picks out those essential bits of information while other methods miss them.
Really brings it home, doesn't it? It's not just about theoretical performance. It's about seeing the practical benefits in action.
All right, ready for our fifth paper? This one's about making those powerful language models smaller without sacrificing accuracy.
Always a desirable goal. Smaller models are easier to deploy and require less computational power.
Exactly. They call this approach branch-merge distillation.
Distillation, that's where you train a smaller student model to mimic a larger teacher model, right?
Yep. But the problem with traditional distillation is that the student model often loses quite a bit of accuracy compared to the teacher.
Makes sense. It's like trying to cram all the knowledge from a big encyclopedia into a pamphlet. Some information is bound to get lost.
So branch merge tries to solve this with a two-phase approach. In the first phase, the branch phase, they take a large teacher model, in this case DeepSeek R1, and they distill its knowledge into several smaller, specialized student models.
So instead of one student trying to learn everything, they have multiple students, each focusing on a specific area of expertise.
Exactly. They train these students on specific domains like math, science, or coding, using data sets that are tailored to those domains.
It's like creating a team of specialists instead of a single generalist.
Perfect analogy. In the math domain, they even tried out different ways of selecting the training data, but found that it didn't make a huge difference in the end, so they just went with a smaller, more focused data set for efficiency.
Always a good idea to simplify where possible.
Then comes the merge phase. They use a technique called RC fusion to combine those specialized models into a single model.
So they're bringing together the best of all worlds, so to speak. Hopefully, the merged model will have the combined knowledge of all the specialists.
That's the idea. RC Fusion has three main steps. First, they calculate an importance score for each parameter in the models being merged.
Parameters are those numerical values that control the model's behavior, right? So they're figuring out which parameters are the most important for each model.
Yep. They use this measure called KL diversions to do this. It basically tells you how different two probability distributions are.
So they're comparing the distributions of each parameter in the two models being merged to see which parameters have significantly different values.
Then in the second step, they calculate a dynamic selection threshold based on those importance scores. This threshold determines which parameters from the second model they're going to incorporate into the merged model.
Dynamic threshold, meaning it changes depending on the specific models being merged.
Exactly. It's a way to make the merging process more adaptive. And finally, in the selective integration step, they actually create the merged model. They take the first model and selectively add in parameters from the second model based on whether their importance score is above that threshold.
So they're not just blindly combining everything, they're carefully choosing which pieces of knowledge to transfer.
It's a very selective process. Figure one in the paper shows this whole branch merge process visually.
I do love a good diagram.
And they show that this merged model, Tiny R132B Preview, does way better than a model of the same size that was trained using traditional distillation. And get this, it even comes close to the performance of the much larger DeepSeek R1 model on this challenging AIMEE 2024 benchmark.
AIMEE, that's the American Invitational Mathematics Examination, right? A pretty tough test.
Yeah, not easy. Figure 2 compares RC Fusion with other model merging techniques, and RC Fusion clearly comes out on top.
Another win for their method. It seems like their approach to selectively merging knowledge is really effective.
They also did a bunch of experiments to see how different merging strategies and training datasets affected performance. They found that training one big model on all the data at once didn't work as well, because it was too hard for the model to balance all the different domains.
That makes sense. It's like trying to be a master of everything. You end up being a master of none.
Right. So branch merge, with its specialized training and collective merging, seems to be a better way to create these smaller, more efficient models without sacrificing accuracy.
It's a promising approach, especially as we continue to push the boundaries of model size and complexity.
Okay, ready for our final deep dive. This one's all about enhancing the search capabilities of language models.
Because even the most knowledgeable models sometimes need to look things up.
Precisely. We're going to talk about R1 Searcher, which uses reinforcement learning to teach models how to effectively use external search engines.
Reinforcement learning, that's the trial and error approach where the model learns through rewards and penalties, right?
Yep. It's been really successful in other areas of AI, so why not apply it to search? Now, there are already methods for augmenting language models with external knowledge, like retrieval augmented generation or RAG.
RAG, that sounds familiar. It's where you have a retrieval system that finds relevant information from a database or the internet, and then the language model uses that information to answer questions or generate text, right?
Exactly. But RAG methods often rely on complex prompting or supervised fine-tuning, which can limit how well they generalize or make them slower during inference.
So R1 Searcher takes a different approach.
It does. It uses this two-stage outcome-based reinforcement learning process. In the first stage, they train the model to effectively invoke the external retrieval system. So they give it a reward if it successfully initiates the search, and another reward if it formats the search query correctly. At this point, they don't really care about the accuracy of the answer, just that it's learning how to use the search engine properly.
So it's like teaching a kid how to use Google before expecting them to find the right answer.
Precisely. Then, in the second stage, they introduce an answer reward that's based on the accuracy of the final answer the model provides. Now the model has to learn how to use the retrieved information to actually answer the question correctly.
It's a clever way to break down the problem into more manageable steps. First, learn how to search, then learn how to use the results.
And they use a modified version of this reinforcement learning algorithm called Reinforce++ to encourage the model to explore different search strategies.
Exploration is key in reinforcement learning. It's how the model discovers what works and what doesn't.
They tested R1 Searcher on two different language models, Llama-3.1-8B Instruct and Q1-2.5-7B Base. And the results are impressive. It outperforms some really strong RAG baselines, even beating out a smaller version of GPT-4o on those challenging Hotpot QA and 2Wiki datasets.
GPT-4o, that's one of the most powerful language models out there. So beating it even a smaller version is a significant achievement.
They even tested R1 Searcher on a completely new dataset called Bamboogle, using an online search engine. And it still did significantly better than a much larger baseline model. So it seems like those learned search skills can generalize pretty well to new situations.
That's encouraging. It suggests that the model isn't just memorizing specific search patterns, but is learning a more general ability to find and use information.
They were also really careful about the data they used for training, including questions of varying difficulty to avoid certain issues that can pop up during reinforcement learning.
Makes sense. You want to expose the model to a wide range of scenarios to make it more robust and adaptable.
They did a bunch of in-depth analysis comparing different reinforcement learning algorithms, reward metrics, and training datasets. And they found that using the F1 score to measure answer accuracy worked particularly well, and that training on diverse datasets led to better overall performance.
It highlights the importance of those fine-grained details in the training process.
In a really interesting case study, they compared R1 Searcher to a model that was trained using supervised fine-tuning to incorporate search capabilities. And what they found was that R1 Searcher was better at knowing when it needed to actually search for information. It had a better sense of its own limitations. The fine-tuned model, on the other hand, often just tried to answer questions based on its internal knowledge, even when it was wrong.
So reinforcement learning led to a more strategic use of search.
Exactly. It's like the model learned to recognize when it was out of its depth and needed to seek help.
That's a really valuable skill for any intelligent system.
I also found some interesting differences between those Qwen and Llama models. After the reinforcement learning training, Qwen seemed to be better at breaking down complex questions into more manageable sub-questions.
It suggests that different model architectures might have different strengths when it comes to learning how to search effectively.
Yeah, it's something to keep in mind. So overall, R1 Searcher demonstrates the power of reinforcement learning for enhancing the search capabilities of language models.
It's a really exciting direction for research. Imagine a future where language models can seamlessly integrate with external knowledge sources to become even more knowledgeable and capable.
It's a tantalizing vision. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground today, from data selection to quantization, long context models, KV cache compression, model distillation, and even reinforcement learning for search.
It's been a whirlwind tour of some of the most cutting-edge research in the field.
Just to recap those key takeaways, we saw how surprisingly effective simple methods like RDS+ can be for selecting training data, especially at scale.
We learned about RSQ, a novel quantization technique that leverages weight rotation and focuses on important tokens to achieve high performance at very low byte rates.
We explored the forgetting transformer, a promising architecture for handling long sequences of text by selectively forgetting less relevant information.
We discovered Q-filters, a remarkably efficient training-free method for compressing the KV cache during inference, making models faster and more memory efficient.
We delved into branch merge distillation, a clever technique for creating smaller yet highly accurate models by combining the strengths of multiple specialized student models.
And we investigated R1 Searcher, a powerful framework that uses reinforcement learning to teach language models how to effectively use external search engines, boosting their knowledge and reasoning abilities.
It's incredible to see the rapid pace of innovation in this field. Researchers are exploring such diverse and creative approaches to improve these models.
It's a testament to the ingenuity and collaborative spirit of the AI research community.
And it really makes you wonder, how will these different techniques interact and evolve in the future? What kind of synergistic combinations might emerge?
It's an exciting time to be following this field. We're constantly pushing the boundaries of what's possible,
And we're just scratching the surface of what these advancements might enable in the years to come. New applications, new ways of interacting with information, new possibilities for solving complex problems. It's really quite inspiring.
I wholeheartedly agree. It's a field that's ripe with potential, and I'm eager to see what the future holds.
As always, we encourage you to dive deeper into these papers and explore the world of language model research. There's so much to learn and discover.
And who knows, maybe you'll be the one to come up with the next groundbreaking technique.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the ever-evolving world of language models.
Until next time.
See you then.